One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This is it, the beginning of our Faustathon. This is big, and it's gonna take a few months, so we figured we'd start with some background information on Goethe, the man behind Faust. Like with Cervantes, the more you know about the context, the deeper and richer the content. And fortunately, I have an in with a professor of German literature. So for this introductory episode, I interviewed my friend Rachel about Goethe, the Sturm und Drang, Weimar classicism, the origins of the Faust myth, and the persistence of that myth into the present. If you're online, check us out at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. Find us on Facebook at The Cannonball Podcast and on Twitter at Cannonball Pod. The Cannonball is a member of the Agora Podcast Network. Check out some of the other shows in the network at agorapodcastnetwork.com. And if you wouldn't mind taking a quick survey, we'd really appreciate it. Agora is trying to find out who our listeners are so that we can cultivate the network appropriately. If you check out the show notes, you can find a link to the poll. So please click on that link, take the poll, and let us know who you are. One last note, if you're in the New York area and need reading and writing tutoring or are interested in online tutoring, let us know. I have a tutoring business on the side and a newborn, so I'm always looking for a few new clients. If you need some help, send an email to claudemoinc@gmail.com. That's claudemoinc@gmail.com. We can also produce literary lectures on demand. Not entirely certain what situations would call for that, but for some quality literary infotainment, hit us up. Hello, and welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. This is Claude Myron Guzer, and we've got something a little bit different today. Daniel and I are going to be launching into a sort of intensive read of Goethe's Faust, books 1 and 2, or I guess parts 1 and 2. And before we did, we thought it would be beneficial to do some sort of explanatory background information on Goethe, on Faust, on where this fits in with everything, because when we did that with Cervantes, it was really, really helpful to orient Cervantes. Now, I lucked out. I have a friend who is a German professor. So I figured this would be an opportunity to drag my friend Rachel into this and have her explain to us a bit just sort of who Goethe was, what was going on in the writing, what Faust is about, just the general context for understanding how this piece of writing came to be. So, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be here.
All right. Great. That's because we're just starting. All right. So... okay, Goethe lived from 1749 to 1832. So that's a long stretch of time. He lived a good long time. And he occupies this kind of central place in the German language canon. Could you start out, I guess, by giving us a little bit of background information on Goethe and I guess his role in a couple of different movements in German language literature?
Certainly. So, as you were saying, he was born in the middle of the 18th century, and he studied. He did well for himself. He had, you know, had a pretty typical bourgeois upbringing, and he started writing already as a young man, as a student. And so, one of the things that I know you may have noticed about Faust is that it seems a little bit disjointed. And the reason for that is because he started writing pieces of it when he was in his early 20s. So he started at age 21. What I think is really ironic is that he wrote the part about Faust in his study, lamenting having lived his whole life and not having had a lot of meaning and everything like that. And he was writing that as a 21-year-old.
I guess the parallel is Eliot writing Prufrock when he was like 22. It's sort of like, oh, I'm an old man who's wasted my life. You're a kid.
Yes.
Get over it.
The Auerbachskeller, the Auerbachskeller, yeah. The bar scene is something that he actually did a lot when he was a student. He actually visited Auerbachskeller. There was a bar named that.
Oh, wow.
And you know, there's a recreation of it now where you can see kind of a shrine to Goethe.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, and then he returned to the work at various periods during his life. So, you know, starting in, I want to say about, I think I have it written down. Oh yeah. So he started work on it in 1770. I told myself I wasn't going to say 19 for the year, but you know, whatever.
It starts in the hippie era and ends in the disco era.
Pretty much. Yeah. So it's, I should say I'm a 20th century, more of a 20th century scholar myself. So, but you have to know Goethe.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, the sort of major hit, the first major hit was Sorrows of Young Werther, right? Mm-hmm. Has a major cultural impact. Now, is that connected to the Sturm und Drang, or
yes.
Was that pre? Okay. So could you tell us a little bit, for anyone who doesn't know, what the Sturm und Drang was, and maybe a little bit about Werther's connection to it?
Sure. So Sturm und Drang is often translated as storm and stress movement in English. And it was about 1765 to 1785 is typically considered. Those are typically considered the bookend years for it.
Right.
And so this was smack dab during the Enlightenment. And Sturm und Drang was really a reaction against the Enlightenment, against the idea of sort of pure reason and morality being the driving forces behind decisions and things like that. And so Sturm und Drang was all about just passion and emotion and things like that. Werther, as you mentioned, was really considered one of the pivotal texts of it. Mm-hmm. And it was a Bildungsroman, mm-hmm. or sort of like a, young man's journey and everything like that. And really inspired a lot of young, angsty men at the time. I mean, they were really emulating the lead character to the point of, so it's sort of like a pop culture icon almost.
Right.
They were dressing like Werther. They were, committing suicide like Werther.
Right.
So it was just highly influential. And so it made such a splash for Goethe that you know, really he could do anything he wanted after that.
Gotcha. So that sort of established his reputation more or less. And mm-hmm. and he was, I guess, part of the Sturm und Drang along with Schiller? Or sort of like a main driving proponent? Right.
Well, Schiller, I would say, Schiller was also part of the Sturm und Drang. A lot of the main important texts of Sturm und Drang are plays, are theater works that may or may not have been intended to be performed.
I can't imagine performing some of these.
The scope, I mean, I'm just now reading Schiller's The Robbers with my literature students, and we've kind of talked about some of the scenes in the woods where they they're surrounded by hundreds of people on horseback, and how would this work? So Schiller and Goethe, they didn't really meet and become friends until later.
Okay.
I think it was 1794. So
gotcha.
They're considered to be the two sort of main figures of the Weimar classicism.
Okay. So the Sturm und Drang, do I have this straight? The Sturm und Drang sort of bleeds into German Romanticism, but then Weimar classicism is this other kind of thing that occurs sort of concurrently or after the Sturm und Drang, but concurrently with the Romantic movement?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And German Romanticism was really kind of fashioning itself, setting itself up against Weimar classicism.
Okay. So what then was Weimar classicism?
So it's really, I would say, as you said, it was right after Sturm und Drang. Goethe started traveling. He traveled to Italy. He kind of wanted to get back into using classical models, as opposed to Sturm und Drang was really getting away from the Greeks. Weimar classicism was reestablishing the connection to Greek aesthetics.
Okay.
It's complicated.
Hell, we have PhDs, of course it's complicated. Even if it's not, we find ways to complicate things. But, the move then is sort of to flee this kind of classicism with the Sturm und Drang, but then come back to it with the sort of Weimar classicism. Did the Sturm und Drang just kind of wear itself out? Did it just kind of reach an endpoint? Did it become untenable? What was the move there? Or at least, okay, if you can't speak generally to it, because I guess the generalizations are kind of useless to a degree. What was Goethe's position there? Why did he move from one thing to the other?
Well, I think part of it was what was going on in the world in general, and particularly with the French Revolution. I think Sturm und Drang was really made up primarily of young 20s people, and mostly men in their 20s, mm-hmm. And really kind of trying to look for something new. They were looking to this idea of, freedom and, subjectivity, freedom of expression and that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And then when they saw how this came into play in actuality in the French Revolution and then the aftermath, they kind of went, some of them at least kind of went, hey, wait a minute, this isn't exactly what we had in mind. And I think part of it also was just, they were maturing and they were, looking for something maybe a little bit more staid and that they could, that and sustainable.
Gotcha. So it sort of is that way that, I mean, I'm thinking in terms of English Romanticism, this way that the French Revolution, it had this power to galvanize, but it also like to sort of energize this younger audience, or this younger group. But it also, once it turned bad and got really bad, Reign of Terror, and then on into Napoleon and the Napoleonic Wars, there was a real turn against it. I mean, thinking in terms of Wordsworth and Coleridge completely turning on their earlier ideals. Okay. Yeah, please.
Yeah, certainly. And then, and as I was saying, you know, you had kind of the two movements that grow out of Sturm und Drang. So Romanticism, German Romanticism, and Weimar Classicism. But Schiller and Goethe were really at the core of Weimar Classicism. And as I mentioned before, they became friends in 94 and collaborated on some things and did, had a correspondence and really saw each other as being very like-minded.
Gotcha.
And Weimar Classicism really lasted until it's often considered to the heyday of it to have lasted until Schiller's death.
Okay.
In 1805, but it was, you know, the torch was carried on with it.
Okay.
But the Romanticists really saw the Classicists as being kind of the villains. They're like, they sold out.
So, okay. So the parallel would be the way that I guess this is for the English speaking audience. I guess in English Romanticism, you had that younger cohort, the Shelley circle, the Byron circle, the sort of satanic school, so-called, which turned on the earlier Romantics for selling out the revolution. That kind of, there seems to be a sort of parallel phase, except it didn't coalesce. Like the earlier guys didn't coalesce into a new movement in English Romanticism. All right. So, you had mentioned something off air when we were talking about what Goethe was like, or sort of general attitude as a kind of combative iconoclast or someone who, you know, whatever it is, I'm against it. You know, whatever you bring to the table, I'll find a way to fight against it. And you had this fascinating anecdote about his rejection of Newtonian physics in favor of color theory.
Right. I mean, I think he just enjoyed being contrary.
Okay.
And so he was kind of a curmudgeonly in the sense that he kind of thought he knew, he kind of dabbled in everything and was could be a dilettante in pretty much anything. But he, I feel, thought that he knew more than anybody else, and he could just go into any field and just show, trying to refute Newton.
Okay. So kind of like a less successful Stravinsky. That's what, I had a music appreciation class where the professor told us, Stravinsky's reputation amongst other composers was that, at every phase of musical modernism, somebody would innovate something, you know, bizarre and strange and brilliant. And then Stravinsky would step in, do that, perfect it, and then move on to the next weird innovation that somebody else had done, come in, perfect it, and then just move on because he got bored. So this sounds like Goethe was in some ways attempting to jump into other people's work and perfect it and move on, but not always as successfully. But I just loved that idea. Okay, I'm going to go to war with Newtonian physics, just out of contrariness, like just that general attitude. It says something about it.
Yeah, I certainly, and he definitely had a high opinion of himself.
Okay, so he dabbled in a lot of different kinds of literature, and you know, we were talking off air about how central he still really kind of is to German writing. What is that centrality? Is it that he had a hand in all kinds of literature? He did plays, he wrote poetry, he wrote sort of novels or proto novels. Is it just his facility with a wide variety of forms, or is there something else there that writers really sort of have to encounter?
Well, I definitely think it was, for one thing, he, as you said, he really did a lot with a lot of genres. His longevity certainly didn't hurt because he was able to be really prolific. He lived a long life. I think he lived to be 80, 84, something like that.
Yeah.
83, 84.
Yeah.
And so he really, his lifetime just spanned so many different literary movements and sort of historical events that he could be reacting to. And I think he, you know, he was around when sort of German literature and language was being shaped into sort of what it is today. And he was just right in the thick of it.
Gotcha.
And I just think also he's probably partially still considered so relevant because he's the German author that's just most widely known. I mean, he's, you know, everybody reads Goethe in school if you're a German speaker.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. So he's known throughout the German speaking world as this kind of central figure. And it's, I guess it's sort of like if you're in high school, you have to read a Shakespeare play. If you're German speaking in high school, you have to read something by Goethe.
Yeah. You would read Goethe. You would read Schiller.
Okay.
Yep.
Gotcha. So it's that inescapable thing because our teachers keep giving it to us.
Yeah, right, they're the chestnuts.
Gotcha. All right. So let's turn for a little bit to Faust itself. Now, you said he started it when he was a young man. He started it more or less when he was a student. Put it away, picked it back up, put it away, picked it back up, put it away, picked it back up. What is going on with this thing? Why does he keep starting and stopping with this?
Well, I think he just kind of got, thought he had gotten to the end of the road with it, potentially. Mm-hmm. He published several sections of it as a fragment in the 90s, 1790. And I think he perhaps thought he had come to the end of the road with it, but then... I don't know, just got after Schiller's death, had the inkling to pick it back up and see what else he could do with it.
Okay. Now, the weirdness of this is that it's essentially based on a legend about a guy who sells his soul to the devil. Goethe was raised Lutheran, right?
Mm-hmm.
But kind of sort of more or less gave up on any kind of Orthodox Christianity. Right.
Yeah. I mean, he really saw himself more as just, you know, questioning the traditional notions of faith. He really saw himself as having kind of his own private religion.
Well, why was that? What did Lutheranism do or not do? I mean, why go... All right. Was this his contrarianist? Did he have a sort of theological argument, or was this sort of like religion is dry and boring and sort of takes the life out of life kind of thing?
Probably a little of both. I mean, it's interesting to read the different things that Goethe wrote about religion, faith, and his own personal relationship with faith. Mm-hmm. It really is, to my mind at least, and I'm not a Goethe scholar. There are people who spend their entire professional lives just on Goethe. But it, you know, from what I've read, it's he writes something, and then the next day he, you know, or the next year he writes something that seems to completely contradict it. And so it's a little hard to pin down what he actually thought about religion.
Gotcha. So he's not even doctrinaire in his own anti-doctrinaire stance.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess that's a kind of honesty that he keeps thinking and rethinking and keep working. And, you know, listeners know that, or I think listeners know because I've ranted a little bit on here. I do not have an affinity for Emerson. Emerson annoys the hell out of me, but I do respect the ways that he's open to change over time. You can see sort of like shifts and moves that he's thinking and rethinking things. It sounds like Goethe is in a similar mode. That's really kind of admirable in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, I think there's something you can really say there's something for everyone in Goethe, which might also speak to his popularity.
Gotcha.
I mean, I am not a huge fan of Faust, to be honest.
Right.
There are a couple of his other works that I also have some problems with, like Elective Affinities. Mm-hmm. We won't go into that right now necessarily, but, you know, some of his poetry, especially his later poetry, I really enjoy and appreciate.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, he wrote as an older man, he wrote some things that were almost not, I don't want to say naive, but just sort of almost sweet in their mm-hmm. nostalgia and kind of yearning for youth and looking forward to, you know, kind of with not dread, but just sort of a little bit of sadness toward the end of life and things like that. So, like I said, I feel like there's something, even if you have a strong reaction, because I feel like some of his works are pretty polarizing.
Yeah.
That even if you have a strong negative reaction to one of his things, you might find something else in his oeuvre that you could latch onto and enjoy.
Gotcha. All right. So let's go back to Faust for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And the question of theology. All right. It does just seem a really strange choice. If you're not exactly a believer, why are you going to this source that is so deeply rooted in these ideas of faith? I mean, in Faust, he really tweaks it. He really changes it around. It's idiosyncratic in terms of what exactly it means for Faust to be engaging in this wager. I mean, Goethe transforms it from being, I guess, a sell your soul type of thing to more of like a bet.
Yes.
And it's closer to Job than to the Faust legend. Why then would he be drawn to this particular legend?
Well, he said himself that he originally started working on it with a couple of influences in mind. One was a real case of a woman who killed her child. Sorry, spoiler for people who haven't read it.
200 years old, 300 years old. I think we're fine.
Okay. Like but he, you know, he had read an account and there's, I think, if I remember correctly, there's some notion that he might have even gone to the execution.
Oh, wow.
But also in the air was there was a Faustbuch, a book written about this real supposed real figure, Faustus, that had lived a couple centuries earlier and was supposed to have really been able to do supernatural things with the help of the devil. But more, I think more present for Goethe, his more immediate influence were these puppet plays that would take up the figure of Faust and for entertainment purposes, and sort of like a traveling troupe would go around to different towns and put on this performance. So I think that might be part of the reason that there's such a, that Mephistopheles is such a almost kind of like a sarcastic,
witty
character, is because it's coming more, it's more immediately influenced by these plays. Puppet plays, like a low form of entertainment.
Okay, so there's this weird thing that's going on. It's popular entertainment. It's low entertainment. It's sort of children's theater, I guess, if you will, or at least that's my understanding of puppet shows, just because I have kids who you can probably hear in the background. But is he trying to elevate the material, or does he see something in the material that he thinks is localized in this way that hits at, I guess, German language writing, or that exemplifies something about the people? Or is it just sort of like, hey, here's a cool idea, I wonder if I can elevate it?
Yeah, I think, you know, when he first started out, like I said, he was 21. And so I think he was just kind of trying something and, you know, kind of experimenting around with what he was hoping to do as a writer.
Okay. So it's just sort of like, let's see where this goes. And then over time, it develops in all kinds of different weird ways.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. So Faust isn't exactly your favorite Goethe. What are the problems you have with it, if you don't mind addressing some of those?
I mean, my personal frustrations with it, of course.
Okay. I don't mean to interrupt you.
Sure.
Let me pull back for 1 second and say the reason I'm asking is because one of the things, or one of the impulses behind this show, is to start talking about our affective responses to the works that, you know, we study, we have to teach. We often engage these things in the sort of abstract, intellectual way. But I like talking to my friends about, okay, yeah, but how do you feel about it? Like, I had my friend, Matt on here to talk about Molière, and, you know, he was, espousing on Molière. He was espousing on Montaigne because he loves French literature. And, you know, we had this conversation and he said, you know, I can do all this intellectual stuff with extraordinarily boring plays, because he's a drama professor. And he said, but I really love talking about this stuff and I never get to talk about it because it's stuff that, you know, it's sort of outside of the field, but it's something that he really feels for. So to pull back around, if you don't mind addressing that affective response, what is it that you have a problem with Faust? Because I also have problems with Faust.
I mean, I guess for me, of course, I think I was telling you before, as a grad student, I read this originally when I was studying for my comprehensive exams with a group of fellow female grad students. Mm-hmm. And we had sort of our conversations were around, we found the Gretchen story so frustrating. You know, obviously it's a sign of the time, and obviously she's a type. He was, you know, kind of instrumentalizing this figure to just be sort of another.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I don't know, station along the way in the quest for, you know, what Faust is looking for, ultimate understanding of the universe and how, you know, how everything is woven together. But it's just, she's just sort of this frustrating cardboard figure to me. And you just want to go, wake up, you kind of want to smack her and say, wake up, he's not worth it. He's not who you think he is, that kind of thing. But you have to, and it's hard for me to understand, I guess, exactly what Goethe is trying to critique with this whole relationship.
Yeah. Okay. Going into it on this reread, I was really, really frustrated with Faust because it was like the character, he's a jerk.
Yeah.
When he has the potential to really sort of expand and do all this other stuff, he gets caught up in basically seducing and abandoning this poor woman. She means next to nothing to him except an obsessional object. I really felt like you were right. It's sort of like, all right, the thing I always talk about when I'm doing Hamlet is, okay, Hamlet is really, really bad to Ophelia.
Yes.
So is every other character in that play. In this weird way, Shakespeare also does a bad turn to Ophelia by having her be this kind of like blank, pathetic figure. She serves as nothing but this kind of blank, pathetic figure. There have been, tremendous analyses of her and stuff like that, but sometimes they don't quite seem convincing because there's not much there. We're not given much to work with. And that seems to be like, you could put it at Shakespeare's feet, right? There's this way that I think you're right. Gretchen is this cardboard cutout character and Faust is just this jerk.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading Faust right now with in a faculty reading group with a group of all male colleagues. Mm-hmm. And I brought up this same frustration. And that was precisely, it's interesting that you bring up Ophelia, because that was precisely one of the things that they said to sort of try to defend. Mm-hmm. Faust and by proxy Goethe. I think it's very Shakespearean. She's very Ophelia like.
Maybe not the best ammunition though.
No.
You might want to recheck that. I think we were talking off air. The one character I find the most fascinating, or the one, this I think says more about me than it says about the play, but the one character I latch onto is Mephistopheles, probably because of that kind of ironic nihilistic humor. Just at every step of the way, he's just subtly tweaking and tearing everything apart.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely the most interesting character. Yeah. and the most enjoyable, I think.
Yeah. So, all right. It's composed in this weird hodgepodge way. He keeps returning to it. And the ultimate effect is to have, I keep thinking about The Wasteland. It's a fragmented work. Right. It's in these bits and pieces, perhaps not as openly fragmented as The Wasteland. But the reason I keep going back to The Wasteland is because in the early 20th century, Eliot was supposed to have been so innovative in that technique. And I was like, well, hang on. I think there are things that were already done. But it has this fragmentary quality. So, OK, it's almost like. It's these jagged scenes that he doesn't really take the time to smooth over into a coherent whole. So it's sort of like jerking here, jerking there. There are these radical tonal shifts. I mean, sometimes even within the scene where you're like, wait a minute, I thought I was supposed to be laughing about this one. Why did he keep it that ragged? Like, what was the impulse?
Well, there's a lot of speculation on that. I don't think that there's any one answer that explains it satisfactorily. I think I referred to it as a Frankenstein's monster of a work at some point. But, yes, as you said, he doesn't really you know, he doesn't do this big revision and smooth it all out and put in transitions and make it stageable, make it readily stageable. And I'm not sure why. My thought is that perhaps because Faust, just as Margareta is supposed to be a type, that maybe as he goes through these different attempts at finding what he's looking for, that as Mephistopheles is leading him through these different kind of almost vignettes, that he could just be representing man's different attempts at trying to find fulfillment or meaning.
Gotcha. So
in the Age of Enlightenment, when it's almost frustratingly impossible.
Gotcha. So there's this way in which the structure is an echo of this quest motif going throughout, how he keeps coming and going and coming and going and coming and going. There's no one thing that can coordinate the whole.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. All right. Thanks. I have some more questions, and I'm going to ask the one that you can't answer, and then I'm going to ask some that you can. But the one that you can't answer, and this is kind of a joke saying you can't answer it, I'm sure you can come up with something, but do you have any insights on Faust Part 2?
I don't, and I guess I would say it's very surreal.
Yeah.
Very bizarre. I haven't read it in so long that I probably won't want to try to venture something on that.
Gotcha. Because that's what we're kind of leading up to is Faust Part 1 is the sort of preface to us reading Faust Part 2, and we're going to do a deep dive through that. But it's just so bizarre. I've read it 3 or 4 times, and every time I'm like, what the hell did I just read?
We're planning to read Faust Part 2 in the faculty reading group. And so, I can come back and let you know, what my, 19th century, specialist colleagues tell me to think about it.
Okay, what they tell you to think about. So this faculty reading group is going quite well. No, but tell them I have a question, and that question is, what the hell? All
right, so anyway. That'll go over really well, I'm right. sure.
Okay, but the one that I think you can answer, like your field is 20th century German literature, like you focus on the 20th century. What is the afterlife of Faust? I mean, I know there's Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus, which takes it and riffs on it in just amazing ways. But how has Faust resonated beyond just the moment? You said you were interested in the ways that the Faust legend or the Faust myth or what Goethe does with it keeps having these resonances in German language literature.
Yeah. That's a big question. Very big question.
Should we go back to Faust Part 2? Is that...
I'm fascinated by Dr. Faustus, Mann's Dr. Faustus, but it, you know, the whole idea of the Faustian deal, the Faustian wager, mm-hmm. Of course, has made it its way into world literature as a motif. I mean, you know, there are even musical, musicals that we know, Damn Yankees or things like that, that have taken it up. And I don't know that that would have happened if it hadn't been for Goethe.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. So he changed the status of the legend. It started as this kind of low figure, and then he elevated something in it or popularized something in it. Marlowe's Faustus was back there earlier, but he hadn't even read Marlowe, right?
Right. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And Marlowe's Faustus is a god-awful mess. It's in a couple different versions. They don't always cohere. It's bits and pieces all over the place. There are tons of it that you're wondering, why in the world would this have been included? It's really fragmentary and strange, but he hadn't even encountered that. So it begins to develop or grow legs once he gets his hands on it.
Yeah. And it's not, I think, not really a morality tale, which is what it differentiates it from Marlowe. I mean, it doesn't have a pedagogical purpose, really.
Right.
I think it's just sort of an exploration of something that really resonated with people. Sort of, okay, our entire world has changed and been turned on its head, and is still in flux, and it's really difficult to deal with. And so, just sort of dramatizing that struggle really, you know, made a big impact, because it was something that everybody was trying to deal with if they were paying attention and thinking at all.
Well, no, I mean, that's really insightful. I can think of two romantic operas based on Faust, and I can think of a couple of other romantic compositions based on Faust. Liszt did a few, and so on and so forth. You know, there's that weird moment. You're talking about it as being not a morality tale. You know, the other repeated legend that I can think of again and again before Faust is the Don Juan story.
Right, exactly.
Which is a morality tale. It's pretty clearly a morality tale.
Yeah.
And then you have Mozart, you know, screwing with it with Don Giovanni, which makes it much more ambiguous, and then he's on the cusp of, I guess, everything that becomes the romantics in a way. I mean, the timing is sort of off a little bit, but you get to this moment of a very ambivalent Don Juan figure, and then you move into Faust. It almost seems like this cultural progression in a way, but I might be reading too simplistically.
Well, no, you know, the Don Juan figure and the Faust figure are considered to be kind of, I would say, almost two sides of the same coin.
Right.
In terms of what does the individual look like in modernity? I mean, there's the whole book about it, right? The myths of modern individualism. Both of them are given a lot of time in that book, space in that book. But interestingly, Faust isn't really in. He's not taking up a whole bunch of dalliances and keeping score, right? He's basically doing pretty much the opposite, and he's hoping to find the ideal in one woman.
Right, right, right. So it's almost like the data-driven enlightenment side versus the transcendental idealism of romanticism, but still using women as the vehicle to find the end result. I think you're right in pointing out the underlying misogyny. That's a really disturbing aspect of the play.
Right. And I think in general that you don't have very many female characters in these things. If you do, they really are, as I said, they're types. They're not they're not meant to be anything other than something for the male protagonist to project onto.
Right. So finally, if we could talk just very briefly about the versification, you'd mentioned that what is the versification of Faust? Like, what is the Shakespeare had iambic pentameter. Does Goethe have a line, or does he have a form, or does he have like a poetic genre that he uses?
Well, I think originally, if I'm remembering this correctly, he wrote it in prose.
Okay.
And so the aspects of it, and I think this is another reason why it reads as so choppy, is that he's pulling from different traditions and pulling from different genres, which was actually a really common thing in Sturm und Drang. This idea of sort of mixing genres together, abandoning the rules, the kind of stodgy rules that you saw prior to that in somebody like Klopstock. Really getting into pulling together prose and lyric, and I'm saying lyric poetry.
Right.
Sometimes sprinkle in a couple of German words here and there, because I'm thinking and translating back into English.
No, it's fine.
But he's pulling a lot from the kind of German folk song tradition, the German Germanic verse tradition, as opposed to sort of more romantic traditions.
And then
pulling, you know, trying to make it kind of a Shakespearean influence German verse.
So you get the thing that we were sort of talking about, it was the way that it occupies a couple of different registers at once. Like, he can do the high verse, he can do the high Shakespearean rhetoric, then he can go to this kind of like low verse or I guess popular verse, or even just bawdy,
drinking songs. Yep.
So that's one of the things that I found kind of like structurally fascinating about it. Turning to Goethe after Samuel Johnson was kind of a relief. We did not have a fun time with Johnson. But part of what made it really sort of fascinating or weird was the way that it had that kind of, okay, so here's the scene where we have this deep, dark lamenting over the fate of humanity. And then, hey man, we're going to go to a pub and you're going to ride a barrel and it's going to fart fire. And then you're going to fly off into the night. It can go like high and low. I mean, just within a very short amount of space. And there's something really sort of exhilarating about that, I found.
Mm-hmm. And I think it speaks to his actual life experience and his personality. He did like to party as a student, So I think some of those things that he includes that are almost silly, lowbrow, even sometimes kind of whimsical. He was just kind of reliving his frat boy days. Not really frat boy, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, more or less. Gotcha. Okay, well, thank you so much, because this has really helped to contextualize Faust, to think about it in a couple of different registers, to think about it in terms of its resonance further on, to think about how it was composed, why it was composed, where it fits, and how Goethe fits into this whole thing. And thank you so much for speaking to your, I guess, personal reactions to the text. I mean, that's really what this is all about, is, okay, after the analysis, how do we really feel about these works of art that we're made to teach over and over and over again? But please.
It was fun, and just as a warning, I'm sure that there were some inaccuracies in here. This is my disclaimer, so that I'm imagining the hate mail is gonna start pouring in as soon as this drops. So
well, we do have some listeners in Germany, we'll see what happens. But if we do receive hate mail, they're very kind people, and if we do receive hate mail, you will never hear about it. So thank you, Rachel,
for coming on.
I really appreciate it.
No problem.
That was a lovely discussion.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.